A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the rearmament narrative pick up steam across Europe, and he's asking what's actually happening on the ground. The framing is interesting. For decades after the World Wars, the European project was built on harmony, standardization, collective defense through NATO and the EU. Now, with Ukraine grinding into its third year, and immigration politics fragmenting the continent, we're seeing governments talk about defense spending, not as a NATO obligation to Washington, but as something they need for themselves. The question is, what does that look like practically? Who's spending what, and what are they actually buying?
The numbers are genuinely striking, and I think the first thing to understand is the scale of the reversal. Germany alone. And this is the country that for 75 years treated military restraint as almost a constitutional identity. Germany has now committed to a 100 billion euro special fund for the Bundeswehr, and they've enshrined defense spending above 2% of GDP in their basic law. That's a permanent shift, not a one-time response to February 2022.
The basic law part is what jumps out. You can raid a special fund once. You can't easily walk back a constitutional commitment without another major political moment.
And it's not just Germany. The European Commission put forward a defense industrial strategy last year that aims to have member states procuring at least 40% of their defense equipment collectively by 2030 and 50% of their procurement spend within the EU by the same deadline. Those are concrete benchmarks with monitoring mechanisms. That's not rhetoric. That's a procurement pipeline being built.
40% collectively, which implies they're nowhere near that now.
Right now, European nations still buy the vast majority of their major systems from the United States, and they do it in a fragmented way. 27 different procurement processes, 27 different maintenance chains, 27 different ammunition standards in some cases. The Commission's argument, and I think it's a sound one, is that this fragmentation is a strategic vulnerability. If you've got 14 different types of main battle tank operating across EU armies, and they all need different spare parts and different ammunition, you don't actually have an integrated defense capability. You have a museum of incompatible hardware.
A museum of incompatible hardware. That's the European defense industry in four words.
It really is. And the Ukraine war exposed this brutally. When everyone started shipping artillery shells to Kyiv, they discovered that the shells weren't interchangeable across different systems. A French Caesar howitzer and a German Panzerhaubitz 2000 use different ammunition. So you've got warehouses full of shells that can't be used by the system next to them. The European Defense Agency has been screaming about standardization since 2004, but nobody wanted to pay the political cost of telling their domestic defense contractors to harmonize.
Because telling a French defense contractor to build things the German way is like asking a winemaker to switch to beer.
It's asking them to standardize their bottles so they fit in someone else's crate. And defense contracting is the most politically protected industry in Europe. Every country wants to preserve its own industrial base, its own jobs, its own technological sovereignty. The result is that Europe has something like 170 different major weapon systems, compared to about 30 in the United States, for a combined defense budget that's roughly a third of the Pentagon's.
The practical question is, are they actually fixing this, or are they just announcing that they intend to fix it?
Both, and the balance depends on which country you're looking at. Let me give you some specifics. Poland is the most dramatic case. They're now spending over 4% of GDP on defense, which is the highest in NATO. They've signed deals for 366 Abrams tanks from the US, 1,000 K2 tanks from South Korea, 672 K9 self-propelled howitzers, and they're building what will be, by headcount, the largest army in Europe. The Polish defense minister said last year they want to reach 300,000 active personnel.
Poland is building a land army like it's 1938, and they've read the sequel.
That's not even a joke. Polish strategic culture is fundamentally shaped by geography. They're the flat bit between Germany and Russia. Every Polish security planner thinks in terms of territorial defense and conventional deterrence. What's changed is that they now have the economic growth to actually fund it. Poland's GDP has doubled since joining the EU, and they're channeling a significant portion of that into hardware.
The Baltic states.
Estonia and Latvia are both above 3% of GDP now. Lithuania is just under 3%, but climbing. These are small countries with small budgets in absolute terms, but as a share of their economy, they're outspending almost everyone. Estonia, in particular, has been fascinating to watch. They built a very capable cyber defense command, they've got a well-trained reserve force, and they've been the loudest voice in NATO, saying the alliance needs a credible conventional deterrent in the Baltic region, not just a tripwire force.
The tripwire concept being, we station just enough troops that if you invade, you kill some Americans or Brits, and that triggers Article 5. The troops aren't there to stop an invasion. They're there to die and make it politically impossible for the alliance not to respond.
And the Balts have been arguing for years that this isn't sufficient against a Russia that might test whether Article 5 actually holds. Their argument is, we need enough force in place that an invasion fails on its own terms, not just that it triggers a political process in Washington and Brussels. The rearmament push is partly a response to that argument gaining traction.
The eastern flank is spending real money on real hardware. What about the western half of the continent? Because when I read Europe is rearming, I picture the Germans and the French and the British, and my skepticism reflex activates.
Your skepticism reflex is well calibrated. Let me walk through the major western players. Britain, outside the EU now, but still a major European military power, has been trying to rebuild after what even the Defense Committee called a hollowed-out force. They've committed to increasing defense spending to 2.5% of GDP, with a pathway to 3%. They're building new frigates, they've got the AUKUS submarine deal with Australia and the US, and they're expanding their nuclear deterrent infrastructure. But they're also struggling with recruitment. The British Army is at its smallest size since the Napoleonic era.
Since the Napoleonic era. That's a phrase that should make someone pause before breakfast.
It should, and it's not just a British problem. The German Bundeswehr has been running recruitment campaigns that have been, let's say, creatively desperate. They've tried TikTok influencers. They've tried advertising on gaming platforms. There was a whole controversy about whether the Bundeswehr's social media presence was too casual, too try-hard. The underlying problem is that after the Cold War, most Western European countries abolished conscription and never figured out how to make military service attractive in a volunteer force.
Creatively desperate is a phrase I'm going to hold on to. What does Germany's actual procurement look like beyond the 100 billion euro headline?
The 100 billion euro Sondervermögen, the special fund, has been allocated across several major programs. They're buying 35 F-35 fighter jets from the US to replace their aging Tornadoes, which is significant because the Tornadoes were the aircraft certified to carry American nuclear weapons as part of NATO's nuclear sharing arrangement. They're buying 60 Chinook heavy lift helicopters. They're upgrading their air defense with the Arrow 3 system from Israel and the Iris-T system, and they're trying to build a next-generation tank and fighter jet jointly with France.
Trying being the operative word there, I assume.
The Franco-German projects are a masterclass in everything that makes European defense cooperation difficult. The Future Combat Air System, the next-gen fighter, has been bogged down in disputes about workshare allocation, intellectual property, and export controls. Dassault and Airbus are constantly at odds over who gets to build what. The main ground combat system, the next-gen tank, has similar problems between KNDS and Rheinmetall. These projects were announced with great fanfare in 2017 and 2018, and they're still in the conceptual phase.
The joint projects that are supposed to embody European strategic autonomy are stalled by the exact same dynamics that made European defense procurement fragmented in the first place. There's something almost beautiful about that.
It's the European Union in miniature. The aspiration is integration. The reality is national interests negotiating under a shared flag. But here's what I think the press often misses. The joint projects are the shiny objects, but the real integration is happening in less glamorous areas. Common maintenance depots. Shared training facilities. The European Peace Facility has channeled billions of euros into reimbursing member states for weapons they've sent to Ukraine, which is effectively a coordination mechanism for collective defense spending that didn't exist before 2021.
Explain the European Peace Facility. That's not a name that suggests it buys artillery shells.
It's an off-budget EU fund. The name is a masterpiece of Brussels branding that was originally designed to finance peacekeeping operations in Africa. After the Ukraine invasion, it was repurposed to reimburse member states for military aid to Ukraine. As of early this year, it's disbursed over 11 billion euros. The significance is that it's the first time the EU has collectively financed lethal military aid. That's a taboo broken. The EU treaties technically prohibit using the common budget for military purposes, so the peace facility is a workaround. It's funded by member state contributions outside the normal budget framework.
So the EU is rearming through a budgetary loophole, essentially.
Through a series of creative interpretations of what peace facility means, yes. And that's actually how European integration has always worked. You don't amend the treaties because that requires unanimity and referendums. You find a mechanism that technically complies with the existing rules while doing something the rules weren't designed for.
Like adopting a feral cat and calling it a houseplant.
I'm going to use that next time I teach European institutional law. But the point is serious. The institutional machinery for collective defense spending is being built in real time, and it's happening through these workarounds rather than through grand treaty changes. The European Defense Fund, which is a 7.9 billion euro pot for collaborative research and development, is another piece of this. It's small compared to the Pentagon's research budget, but it didn't exist before 2021.
Let me pull on the immigration thread from the prompt, because I think it connects to this in ways that aren't obvious. The prompt mentions growing unease as to the consequences of lack of immigration restrictions, alongside Ukraine as a driver of rearmament. What's the link?
I think there are two links, one direct and one indirect. The direct link is that uncontrolled migration is increasingly framed as a security threat, which expands the definition of what defense means. When governments talk about protecting borders, they're now talking about both military borders and migratory borders in the same breath. The EU's border agency, Frontex, has seen its budget more than double in the last 5 years, and it's now the EU's largest agency by staff. That's defense spending by another name.
The indirect link?
The indirect link is political. The populist parties that have gained ground across Europe, from Meloni in Italy to Le Pen's national rally in France to the AfD in Germany, all run on platforms that combine immigration restriction with skepticism of American security guarantees. Their argument is, if Europe can't control its borders, it can't be sovereign, and if it can't be sovereign, it needs its own defense capability rather than relying on a US that might have different priorities. This argument has migrated from the fringes to the center-right mainstream. The European People's Party, which is the largest grouping in the European Parliament, now talks about European defense sovereignty, in language that would have been considered Gaullist or even far-right 20 years ago.
The rearmament push isn't just a response to Russia. It's also a response to a domestic political realignment that's been accelerated by immigration politics.
And I think this is where the US dimension becomes important. The Trump administration has been very explicit that Europe needs to take primary responsibility for its own defense. Secretary of Defense, well, the current one under the second Trump term, has said repeatedly that the US strategic focus is shifting to the Indo-Pacific, and Europe needs to be able to handle conventional deterrence on its own continent. This isn't a hypothetical anymore. The US is asking Europe to step up, and Europe is, unevenly, reluctantly, but beginning to do so.
There's an irony there. The European project was built partly to keep the US engaged on the continent and prevent another war between European powers. Now the US is saying, we'd like to be less engaged, please handle this. And Europe is discovering that the institutional machinery for doing so barely exists.
They're building it while simultaneously trying to maintain the transatlantic alliance. Nobody in a European defense ministry wants to say, we're preparing for a world without American security guarantees, because that would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the language is always strengthening the European pillar within NATO. But the practical effect is the same. More European defense capacity. Less dependence on American logistics. American enablers. American decision-making.
You mentioned logistics. That's the unglamorous thing that actually determines whether an army can fight, What's the state of European military logistics?
Terrible. And this is where the rearmament story gets into the weeds that most coverage ignores. Europe has a massive problem with military mobility, the ability to move troops and equipment across borders quickly. There are bridges in Germany that can't support the weight of modern main battle tanks. There are rail tunnels that are too narrow for the latest armored vehicles. Customs procedures that would slow down a military convoy crossing from Belgium into the Netherlands. The EU has a military mobility action plan, but it's mostly about harmonizing paperwork and upgrading a handful of key infrastructure nodes. The scale of the problem is enormous.
You can buy all the tanks you want, but if the bridge between your base and the potential front line collapses under their weight, you've built a very expensive static art installation.
A very expensive static art installation that requires specialized maintenance personnel. And that's the other logistics problem, maintenance and sustainment. European armies have spent decades running just-in-time supply chains optimized for peacetime efficiency. They don't have the stockpiles of spare parts, ammunition, and medical supplies needed for high-intensity conventional warfare. The British Army, for example, could reportedly run out of ammunition in about 8 days of intensive combat, based on parliamentary testimony from last year.
It's not a military. That's a military-themed weekend experience.
It's a force designed for expeditionary counterinsurgency operations alongside the United States, not for territorial defense against a peer adversary. And retooling from one to the other is a decade-long project that touches everything: training, doctrine, procurement, infrastructure, personnel policy. The money is the easy part. Spending it effectively is much harder.
Let's talk about the nuclear dimension, because that's the elephant in every European defense conversation. France and Britain have independent nuclear deterrents. How does rearmament interact with the nuclear question?
This is one of the most sensitive conversations happening in European capitals right now, and it's mostly happening in private. The French have been offering what they call a European dimension to their nuclear deterrent for years. The idea being that France's vital interests, which its nuclear doctrine protects, have a European dimension. Macron has invited European partners to participate in nuclear deterrence exercises and strategic dialogues. The Germans have been conspicuously quiet about this because German public opinion is deeply anti-nuclear, but behind closed doors, there's a recognition that if American extended deterrence becomes less credible, the French deterrent becomes much more important. Britain's deterrent is operationally independent, but technically dependent on the United States. The Trident missiles are American-designed and maintained. So the British nuclear force is less useful as a hedge against American withdrawal because it's entangled with American technology. The French force is fully indigenous, missiles, warheads, submarines, all French. That makes it the only truly independent European nuclear capability.
Which puts France in an interesting position. If you're Emmanuel Macron, you've been arguing for European strategic autonomy for years, and suddenly events are making your argument for you.
Yet France has been one of the countries most resistant to buying non-French defense equipment through EU mechanisms, because they want to protect their domestic industry. There's a tension between France's vision of European strategic autonomy and France's willingness to actually participate in an integrated European defense market. They want Europe to buy French, which is not quite the same thing as building a European defense industry.
The Glockenspiel of strategic autonomy. It makes a beautiful sound, but you're not quite sure what it's for.
That's going in the show notes. But I should be fair, France is also the European country with the most expeditionary military capability, the most experience operating independently, and the most developed defense industrial base. Their armchair criticism is earned to some degree. They've been doing this while Germany was still debating whether armed drones were ethical.
Let me ask about the economic dimension. Rearmament costs money, and European economies are not exactly booming. Germany is in a technical recession. France has debt to GDP above 110%. Italy's is over 140%. How are they paying for this?
The German special fund is off-budget debt. The EU's proposed defense funding mechanisms involve joint borrowing, which is another taboo broken. The EU issued joint debt for the Pandemic Recovery Fund, and the Commission is now suggesting similar mechanisms for defense. The European Investment Bank has changed its lending rules to allow investment in defense projects. there's a quiet but significant shift happening in European fiscal policy. Defense spending is being carved out as a special category that's exempt from normal budget constraints.
Which, once you create a special category for one thing, everyone wants their thing to be a special category too.
That's the slippery slope argument, and you hear it from the fiscally conservative member states, the so-called frugal 4 or 5. But the counter-argument is that defense is different because it's the prerequisite for everything else. If you don't have security, your fiscal rules don't matter. The Polish finance minister made this point rather bluntly last year. He said something like, "The best fiscal policy is not being invaded."
Hard to argue with that framing.
It's rhetorically effective, but it doesn't answer the question of long-term sustainability. European defense spending is still heavily weighted toward personnel costs rather than investment. Pensions and salaries eat up a large share of defense budgets, especially in countries with conscript-heavy legacies. Shifting that balance toward procurement and research requires either growing the overall budget or cutting personnel, and cutting personnel is politically toxic when you're trying to expand your military.
You end up with more money going in, but not necessarily more capability coming out.
This is the efficiency problem, and it's where the EU's coordination role could actually add value. If member states pool procurement, they get better prices. If they standardize maintenance, they reduce duplication. If they agree on common requirements, they avoid the 14-tank problem. The Commission's argument is that the current system wastes something like 25 to 100 billion euros annually through fragmentation. That's a lot of capability being left on the table.
Yet, as you said earlier, the joint projects keep stalling on WorkShare disputes.
Because WorkShare isn't just about money. It's about preserving the industrial and technological base that each country considers strategically essential. If you're the German Defense Ministry, you don't want to become dependent on a French company for your tank transmissions, because what happens if there's a political dispute and France decides to slow walk the spare parts? Every country has this calculation, and it's not irrational. The question is whether the efficiency gains from integration outweigh the autonomy losses from interdependence.
Which is the same question at the heart of the European project generally.
It's the same question, applied to the most sovereignty-sensitive domain there is. Defense is the hardest case for European integration, which is why it's the last one to be tackled seriously. The fact that it's being tackled at all is historically significant.
Let me bring this back to the prompt's framing about the post-war order. The prompt describes the post-World War II European project as being built on harmony, standardization, and collective defense. And it notes that rearmament represents a reversal. I want to push on that a little. Is it actually a reversal, or is it a return to something older?
I think it's a return to a more normal European condition, with the post-Cold War period being the historical anomaly. From the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 until about 1945, Europe was a continent of armed sovereign states balancing against each other. The post-war project suppressed that dynamic through American security guarantees and European integration. The American guarantee made national defense spending seem redundant, and the integration project made national defense planning seem suspect, like you were preparing to fight your neighbors, which was exactly what everyone had agreed not to do.
What we're seeing now isn't a reversal of the post-war order so much as its erosion back toward the historical mean.
I'd say it's a selective erosion. The EU isn't going to dissolve into armed camps. The economic integration is too deep, and the memory of the world wars is still culturally powerful, though fading. But the idea that defense is a collective good provided by the United States and coordinated through NATO is being replaced by something more fragmented. European countries are renationalizing their defense planning while simultaneously trying to build EU-level coordination mechanisms. It's a hybrid model.
A hybrid model? Europe's specialty?
It really is. And I think the most interesting question for the next 5 to 10 years is whether the hybrid holds, or whether it tips in one direction, toward genuine European defense integration, or back toward fully national defense postures with minimal coordination. The Ukraine war is pushing toward integration, because everyone can see that a coordinated response is more effective. But the domestic politics in several key countries are pushing toward renationalization.
What's the wild card here? The thing that could accelerate or derail the whole trajectory?
There are two. The first is the outcome in Ukraine. If Ukraine collapses or is forced into a settlement that's widely seen as a Russian victory, the rearmament push will accelerate dramatically because the threat will feel existential. If Ukraine stabilizes and the conflict freezes, the urgency might fade and the fiscal constraints might reassert themselves. The second wild card is the U.S. election cycle and the broader trajectory of American foreign policy. If the U.S. continues to signal that Europe is a lower priority, European defense integration becomes a necessity rather than a choice. If the U.S. recommits to NATO in a big way, the pressure comes off.
Both of those are unknowable right now.
Which is why European defense planners are trying to hedge, building capacity without fully committing to a specific strategic posture. It's expensive and inefficient, but it's the rational response to radical uncertainty.
The sloth approach to defense planning. Move slowly enough that you're ready for multiple futures.
I don't think that's a compliment, but I'll take it. The more serious point is that Europe is in a transition period, and transitions are messy. You get contradictory signals. Germany buying American F-35s while France talks about strategic autonomy. Poland building a massive land army while Britain struggles to recruit. The EU creating joint procurement mechanisms while member states sign bilateral deals with South Korean and American suppliers. It looks incoherent because it is incoherent. But incoherence is what a system looks like when it's changing.
If someone asks, is Europe rearming? The answer is yes, but the story is less a unified march toward capability and more 170 different procurement processes, slowly, painfully learning to talk to each other.
With the added wrinkle that some of them are learning much faster than others. The eastern flank is moving at wartime speed. The western core is moving at peacetime bureaucratic speed. And the institutional layer in Brussels is moving at EU speed, which is its own special category.
EU speed, where a decision takes 3 years and everyone calls it a breakthrough.
Sometimes it is a breakthrough, which is the maddening thing. The European Peace Facility reimbursing member states for military aid to Ukraine would have been unthinkable in 2019. The European Investment Bank funding defense projects would have been impossible. These are real changes. They're just happening in a system that's designed to make change difficult.
Which was the point of the system? The post-war architects wanted to make it hard to do anything rash.
They succeeded so well that now the system struggles to do things that are urgently necessary. That's the tension at the heart of European defense policy right now. The institutions designed to prevent conflict are being asked to prepare for it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the Basque language, the subject of a transitive verb is marked differently from the subject of an intransitive verb, a pattern called ergativity. This means that in Basque, the woman fell, and the woman saw the man. Treat the woman as grammatically distinct cases, which is vanishingly rare among the world's languages, and suggests Basque preserves a linguistic structure that predates the Indo-European migration into Europe by thousands of years.
So where does this leave us? Europe is rearming, but unevenly, through workarounds with incompatible hardware, while the institutional machinery catches up. The question I keep coming back to is whether this is enough. Whether the sum of all these efforts adds up to a credible deterrent, or whether it's just enough spending to make everyone feel better without actually changing the strategic calculus.
I think the honest answer is that it's not enough yet, but the trajectory matters more than the current state. 5 years ago, European defense spending was stagnant, and the political will for integration was minimal. Today, spending is rising across the board, the institutional machinery is being built, and the political consensus has shifted. Whether that trajectory continues depends on the wild cards we discussed, Ukraine, American politics, the European economy. But the direction of travel is clear, and it's toward a Europe that takes its own defense more seriously than it has at any point since the end of the Cold War.
The prompt's framing about this being a historical reversal. I think that's right, but with the caveat that history doesn't reverse cleanly. It doesn't go back to where it was. It goes somewhere new that looks like the past in some ways, and nothing like it in others.
Europe is building something that isn't quite a unified army and isn't quite the old system of competing national forces. It's a hybrid, and hybrids are hard to name and easy to dismiss. But they're often the things that last.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're also at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.